You are listening to Fanther Tracks.
Because of the following special program, Wonder Woman and the Incredible Hulk will not be presented this evening.
Time to get all your Star Wars news in a single file. This is Making Tracks. Here are your hosts, Mark Newbold and Mark Mulcaster.
That's not true. That's impossible.
You're listening to Making Tracks. This is episode 41 of the show. I'm your co-host, Mark Newbold, and joining me today, as always, is a guy who will introduce himself fantastically. Mark, over to you.
Hi, I'm fantastically Mark.
How are you, Mark?
I'm all right, mate. Yeah, I'm not too bad, thanks.
We've got loads to talk about on this episode. We've got the final part of our chat with ILM animation supervisor Hal Hickel, so we'll be bringing you that later on in the show. We're going to have a little look at Disney Gallery Episode 6. We've got a listener's question to dive into as well. We'll also have a little look at what's happening over at Rancho Obi-Wan with the Virtual Museum. But first off, Mark, Disney Gallery Episode 6, Process. Have you seen it? And if you have, what did you think of it?
I have seen it. Yeah, I've seen it twice, in fact, bizarrely. I think I've said in a couple of the other episodes previously that I'm all about the process. And when I say that, I'm talking about both the creative process that the directors and the executive producers go through, but also the process of how they've developed this TV series. I think this was one of those episodes which was a bit shorter than we've had previously, yeah. Which is not a bad thing. It's a very important part of the process that if you don't get the pre-production correct, it can really have a massive knock-on effect into production and then post-production. So they've done some new techniques and they've kind of really created this workflow for how they actually iterate the action and kind of really lock down almost the, well, not necessarily the story, the cut before they've even shot anything, which I think is actually quite a fascinating way of doing it. It's obviously very much spearheaded by Jon Favreau and the work he did on Jungle Book and The Lion King. Yeah. And obviously Dave Filoni's informed on the previs side of stuff. So I thought it was just like a really good episode. It's probably not the most exciting for some people, I think, because in some respects it's a little bit abstract as well. It's a little bit kind of like you're talking about creating and almost, you know, finalising an episode before you've actually shot anything, yeah. Which I could actually see from some of my independent film director buddies and stuff. I could see them being a little bit uncomfortable about that to begin with, because that's just not their style. But then, as I explained, because I've had such a heavy kind of VFX-laden show with the use of the volume, that they kind of needed to do this anyway. So this was almost like born out necessity rather than like a flight of fancy, I think.
I enjoyed the episode. It was a bit lightweight in terms of length. The other episodes have been sort of 20 minutes plus, and this was just under 19 with credits. But that being said, there was a lot in there, and it's a new process, and these directors haven't done this before. And by Favreau's own admission, he's learning it as he's going along in that sense, you know, picking up information from Jungle Book and especially from Lion King, and using the knowledge that Filoni's got where, in animation, everything is pre-vised. Everything is laid out before you start making it. So it is a mixture of styles and ways of producing stuff. As a workflow goes, Jeba Chow said, you know, normally she would have 2 or 3 days to prep for an episode. On this, she had 2 months. So, you know, and he's got, and Rick Famuyiwa had come into it from independent filmmaking. And so if he was making a Star Trek episode, let's say, the technology would be stuff that he hasn't seen before from independent film. But to walk into this must be another level above that, because this is ground zero for a lot of the tech. So I thought it was fascinating. It was an episode that I would have liked to have seen more, but I agree with you. I think they probably said as much as they actually could. And with Favreau around the table being the guy that sort of, I mean, he's the voice at the table, isn't he? He's the one that you hear the most. Because yes. He's got that experience from Lion King and Jungle Book, and Filoni's got his experience from animation side of Lucasfilm, and they're merging these two techniques together in a way that no other live action production's probably ever done, using, you know, those two different ways of thinking of broaching a show. Because it must be going from driving on the right side of the road with a more automatic car to the left side of the road with a stick shift sort of thing. It must be a completely different way of approaching these things. I enjoyed it, but I wanted to see more. That was my frustration, was I hoped to see more from it. But again, like you say, it's all new. It's a brave new world, isn't it?
It's a brave new world. And also, I think the one thing that I picked up in this episode, especially more than I think the others, was this was Jon Favreau's show.
Mm.
It really felt like this was not necessarily the creative part, but the... like the organisational part that he's really weighed in quite heavily on. I think it makes sense because like they said in the episode, you have these different directors who have all got different backgrounds and different strengths and that, and actually how do you actually homogenise those into something that is going to be consistent across like a whole series? And of course you really need somebody, you know, like a strong personality at the top like Jon Favreau to really motivate and drive through the vision. And I suppose the fact that he's written all the scripts puts him in a really good place, because it's probably a case of, well, this is what I want to see, or this is what I envision, but what's your take? And they kind of collaborate that way. It's the first time that I think they've really kind of even highlighted the fact they've used the Moven suits rather than motion capture. And it's there's two different types of motion capture. And they've gone with the computer game way of doing it, where you've got the sensors on the suit rather than the balls on the suit. And that basically allows for a lot more freedom. You're capturing slightly less accurate motion capture data, but you're free to then place those bodies and those kind of that data in any environment. Whereas with standard mocap, with the actual dots, you know, the tennis balls on the suit, you know, it's all relative to that camera that is picking up that data. That was quite interesting, I thought. Again, it's just, you know, it ties all into what they've had to use for the volume as well, using the Unreal Engine to kind of create all this kind of environments.
The whole thing is fascinating. And again, you had Favreau talking to his directors and briefly to the ILM crew and to Kathy Kennedy as well. Being such a new way of working up a show, and the fact that they could lay it out in previews and basically do an edit and make changes, and does the script work and does the story flow and all that sort of stuff, I found fascinating. I mean, obviously big movies storyboard, it's basically a fancy way of storyboarding, isn't it? But to the next level where you've actually got a moving version of the show in reality before they film a single frame of live action with an actor, it's just unbelievable.
It probably helps everybody, and any kind of VFX heavy show has to do a certain amount of previs, and so therefore it's a benefit. We're six episodes in, we've got two more left.
On Friday the 12th we've got an episode called Score, which presumably is looking at the music behind the show, and then the final episode on the 19th of June is called Connections, which I would imagine is sort of linking back to other Star Wars properties and films and such. And yeah, I just wonder whether or not they'll do something similar for season two, because having spoke to Hal Hickel, who we'll be back with again in a minute, the process is adjusting and finessing and changing already for season two. You know, they're doing new stuff for season two that they either didn't think to do or didn't know how to do for season one. So season two is obviously going to look more impressive as the technology beds itself in. I just wonder whether they'll do, you know, another Disney Gallery for season two.
That's quite possible. I would quite like it. I suppose it depends on how many massive changes there are to the technology.
Probably more likely to be a one-off thing, isn't it, than a series?
Yeah, I was going to say maybe it could end up being a one-off, or like a slightly more feature-length 1 hour or 90-minute kind of thing. That's the thing. Once you've got a series up and running, hopefully it's more tweaks and it's improving and streamlining the workflows where you can and as technology allows.
Hi, this is Gareth Edwards, director of the best standalone Star Wars film since Caravan of Courage, called Rogue One. You're listening to Panther Tracks. Enjoy.
So on the last two studio episodes of Making Tracks, we've caught up with ILM animation supervisor Hal Hickel, talking about his career inside and outside of Star Wars. We had a special hour-long episode specifically talking about his time in the Star Wars galaxy. But here is the final part of our three-part chat with Hal, talking about his career at ILM and in film. So it wasn't as big of a leap going from sort of hands-on nuts and bolts sort of animation to this click and point mouse sort of driven stuff. The whole process in your head was sort of the same 360 degree thing. You could equate one to the other. It made some sort of sense.
Yeah, it made a lot of sense. A little bit because maybe in the last year or so before I lucked into that spot at Pixar, you know, I'd been trying to read whatever I could get my hands on. Also, Vinton's was making baby steps into using computer animation. They were using some low-end software, and by the time I left, they had bought one Silicon Graphics workstation, and they had a one called Maya then. It was called Alias. They had an Alias on it, and so I could come in at night and sort of poke around in it and read the tutorials and try to learn things. I didn't learn much, but it had at least begun the journey of doing things on a computer with a mouse, because I didn't own my own computer then. I didn't have an email account. I'd never been on the internet. This was, you know, the end of 94. So it wasn't completely a big switch from one to the other. There was a little buffer there, but it was a big change. But I think the thing that helped me was that I was eager to do it. I was excited about it at that point, because I knew many stop motion animators who could care less about computer animation. Just, they just had no interest in it. And there were even some at Pixar who, they were super talented stop motion animators, but you could tell that they had taken the job at Pixar because, well, they need to make a dollar, and it was a job available on a feature at the time. But they didn't love it. There was a little kind of begrudging sort of thing. And I think, you know, that probably must have been a lot harder. I know a stop motion animator who said that it, for them, it was like trying to animate with boxing gloves on. Whereas I was very excited about the technology and the opportunities it presented me and learning something new. So that made the transition easy. It was still a big transition, no doubt, but it that made it easy. And then the other thing is, computer animation kind of has a foot in both worlds, meaning 2D cell animation and stop motion. I always kind of felt that, well, at least for me, it's certainly connected with stop motion. It's a real 3D space that you're in, this little set, and the puppet is an actual 3D object. And so you have to sort of consider all those things in 3D space all the time, rather than drawing just to camera, a sort of, you know, just a 2D image to camera. And CG animation is the same. You've got a little 3D world, and you can look at it from any angle and move your camera around and move your viewpoint around. And there's your little puppet in the middle of that scene. I mean, I think the danger for 3D animators, honestly, is sometimes is maybe not pushing things as far as they could in terms of snap and poses and really playing to camera in a way that in a stop motion scene is harder to do with a sort of bound puppet. Although that said, you know, you look at Leica films now and it's as if gravity doesn't exist. It's amazing. What I mean, and that's a compliment, by the way. What I mean is that, you know, particularly with clay animation, which was the house style at Vinton's. Yeah. When I was, we didn't really make puppets out of anything else. The characters were always clay. That was what we did. And they tended to be kind of solid looking characters. You didn't have a character like, for instance, you couldn't have a character with a big, heavy body, but spindly little legs and tiny feet. It was really difficult to do. So you just didn't really. But now with the marriage of digital cleanup techniques so that you can have sort of a lot of supporting gear for puppets and things while they're being animated, you know, you have these wonderful designs with, they can have skinny little legs and tiny feet or whatever you want, really. And you look at the Leica films and they're so fluid and perfect. I mean, I've never seen such technically perfect and artistically beautiful, but I mean, just in terms of the smoothness of the animation and all that, it's amazing. When I was working in stop motion, I don't think I ever imagined I could get that result. Maybe I didn't work hard enough. but anyways, I think one of the things people love about stop motion and find fascinating about it is that it's a tightrope walk. You know, yeah. When you go into a shot, you've got to get it right, and you're moving everything on each frame, you know, and shooting a frame and really committing to something. And that's beautiful. It's a really beautiful thing about it. It's also really stressful. When I got into computer animation, I liked the fact that I could continue to fix and adjust things. I could sort of work my way out from the center of the character, figuring things out as I went along. And I think because of that, people tend to think that computer animation doesn't have any serendipity or happy accidents and things. And I found that to be untrue. It certainly does. There is the danger, though, with CG, because you can edit it and edit it and edit it and work over it and work over it, that some spontaneity is lost, that you can kind of have a rather dull feeling motion because you're not creating it in the moment. You're just sort of constantly iterating on it. And that is a danger. That is one of the things you have to be careful about. You have to find ways to keep your work feeling fresh and infused with the idea that it was created in the moment rather than labored over for days.
Yeah.
But I enjoyed being able to layer and adjust, and it just worked well with my brain. So I actually enjoyed animating in the computer more than I enjoyed animating in stop motion, although, of course, I still miss the puppets and sets and cameras and things. I love all that, and I love stop motion. But just as an animator, when I got on the computer, I thought, oh, this, yeah, I like this. I can tweak and adjust and rethink in ways that, you know, I didn't have to be conservative about as a stop motion animator, because I didn't want to wreck the shot after a day and a half of effort or whatever. And yeah.
That's a good point, because we said earlier about how the director has his vision and you have a certain amount of latitude within that. And from what you've just said there, because you're trying to imbue these characters with as much reality, like you just said, that spontaneity, that in the moment feel, I guess that you have a certain amount of latitude within, you know, if the director's like, I want this T-Rex to go from the petrol station and then I want him to eat the guy by the window, but then in between you're thinking, well, I'm going to have him look at the car that's going past, or I'm going to have him look up at a plane that flies over, whatever. There's certain little beats that you can add that make it feel like it's actually in that space.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Like, for instance, when I'm working with an animator on my team on a project, I want them to show me things I didn't ask for. I want them to, you know, surprise me with their take on the shot. So I try not to give, particularly when I'm just first turning the shot over, any more direction than is absolutely necessary. Like you said, you know, okay, yes, the dinosaur needs to start here. Our actors are clearly looking at this spot, so it's got to hit this spot by this moment so that it lines up with their eye lines. But outside of that, and so if I get the shot back and the dinosaur slips and crashes into the sign and then hits their mark, and I never even imagined that it was going to do that, I love that. Now, sometimes those ideas don't fit, although I'm always, if I can, and I think it's not too wildly off the mark, I always want to show them to the director rather than, you know, just saying, that's not what I had in my head, so do it differently. Usually I'll say, well, wow, that is not what I was expecting, but it's very cool. I'm going to give it a shot with the director and see what they think.
Yeah.
As I said before, be engaged with the work so that they're bringing ideas to it and they're passionate about it. But when their ideas get shot down, to not be crushed and then be sullen and not, you know,
yeah,
like, okay, fine, just tell me what you want. You know, you've got to understand that it's just part of throwing out ideas and that some of them won't fly is just part of the process. So, you know, I guess what I'm getting at is I try to give animators as much authorship over their work, partly by encouraging them to contribute ideas, but also giving them chunks of shots when possible, rather than just a single shot. If I can give them a run of shots, I think they just get more invested in it and enjoy the work more. And plus, that the reality is that animators have to make demo reels for their next job. And if they have a run of shots, that works better on a reel than a single shot. And that's just a reality of the business I try to remain mindful of and make sure. But you know, encouraging them to contribute ideas. Also, I try to get everybody to speak up in dailies. It doesn't always work. Not everybody feels comfortable. Plus, some people feel like if they talk too much about somebody else's shot, then everyone's going to give them notes on theirs and, you know, weird things like that. But if I've got a group of animators in the room with, you know, these great animator brains and their eyes, I want their thoughts on it. And that, again, I think increases everyone's sense of being a contributor to the process and not just a pair of hands to execute someone else's ideas. The more that their ideas can be part of the process and be used, you know, that's just more rewarding for everyone, I think.
Can't move on without mentioning your Oscar-winning film, Dead Man's Chest. I mean, that when that came out, I mean, anything ILM catches my eye and a lot of people's eye. That film in particular was so well realized. Some people, is that a puppet? Is that, how are they doing that? That's clearly Bill Nighy's face, but look at it. Where do you even start pulling that as a concept together and then making it work? I think the scene when he's playing the organ on the ship, you know, with all the tentacles.
Yeah.
Playing. But how do you just even get there?
Hats off to Gore Verbinski, first and foremost, and his merry band of creative partners. So Jim Burkett and Crash McCreary, of course. And Crash, amazing concept illustrator. He became the production designer, art director on Rango as well. His imagination is boundless. So, but he and Gore and Jim dreamed this character up together. And so when we started on it, we just had Crash's 2D art, which was super detailed. But, you know, we pretty quickly had to figure out, what is this thing in three dimensions? Exactly how many tentacles does it have? How many layers of tentacles? All that kind of thing. So we had Richard Miller at ILM, a long time sculptor, amazing concept sculptor at ILM, sculpt a full-size bust of Davy and then also about a 6-scale head-to-toe sculpt. And between those two things, we were able to kind of figure out the forms and the volumes and, again, like precisely how many tentacles and all that, and really pin it all down in 3D. And then we, you know, got to work in the computer and along in there somewhere. And those sculpts didn't look like Bill Nighy because he hadn't been cast yet. But then he got cast. And so that modified the look of the character a good deal. And, you know, just got to work modeling it and rigging it. And the tentacle beard was probably the single most difficult part of it. It was all tough because, you know, as anyone knows, I think most people know by now, the hardest thing to do in visual effects is digital humans. And while he wasn't a normal human, he still had probably 95% of the difficulties of creating a realistic human and making people believe that he was really there on set with Johnny Depp and et cetera. And so there were tons of things that were difficult about it, getting the textures right, getting movement right and all that. But the tentacle beard was probably the single most difficult thing because it wasn't just a creative problem. It was a big technical problem we had to solve. We couldn't hand animate all those tentacles in every shot. We would still be making the movie now if we'd done that. So we had to come up with a simulation engine that essentially brings the tentacles to life, but then also causes them to react to the movement of the character to, you know, sway back and forth and that kind of thing, jiggle. But they also had to be alive, kind of coiling and twining and getting stuck together and wrapped around each other and all those kinds of things. And it had to kind of be a machine that would just do the anim part of it. In other words, we would track Bill's movement so that it moved exactly the way Bill did. And we'd animate the face because we weren't using the facial capture yet at that time. We'd animate the face by studying Bill's performance and hand animating it. And then we'd hand that off to the creature TDs to do the beard. And it took a long time to get it working. But then when it did work, it worked amazingly well. In fact, by the time we got to the third film, or the second of the two Davy films, those beard shots could be handed off to quite junior creature TDs to execute because the system just worked so well. But getting to that point was a bit nerve-wracking on Dead Man's Chest because we were quite late in the schedule and it still wasn't doing its thing yet. And I remember we had a Christmas break and I couldn't relax the whole Christmas break. And the first thing I did when I got back was ask that we get a meeting together of all the interested parties to really kind of light a fire under it because we had to get it because there was no plan B. It wasn't like, well, that system doesn't come together. We can always do this. It was like, no, this has to work. And it did. Fortunately, as I said, it was brilliant. James Tooley was our head of creature technology on that project, and it was his brainchild, and he was the architect of it, and it really did work brilliantly. It was very complicated and took a while to get it off the ground, but
that must have been nerve-wracking in the sense that I would imagine usually there's at least a fallback position for most things, like some kind of plan B, but you say there was literally nothing else.
There really wasn't a plan B. I will say though that if I'm not afraid of some aspect of a project, then kind of what's the point?
Yeah
You know, but if I get crewed on a show and I think, oh, this is a lot like a couple other shows we've done. I know what we're doing here. All right, well, let's get it done. That's way less fun than you know, laying awake at night and thinking, I'm not 100% sure how we're going to do this, but, you know, we'll figure it out.
Thank you to Hal for giving us so much of his time to catch up with us here on the show. It's been fantastic fun. We've really enjoyed it, and hopefully we'll speak to him again somewhere down the line, maybe near the end of season 2 of Mando when there's more to talk about.
I'm Neil deGrasse Tyson, and you are following Fanthatrax.
So you, live on a previous episode of the show, ordered your Rancho Obi-Wan membership pack as we were talking before we went live with Steve Sansweet and Anne Newman to talk about the Virtual Museum. Your pack turned up. What did you make of it? Because I, you know, I absolutely adore my annual Rancho pack. What did you think of your first one?
I thought it was great. It was quite a nice surprise that it arrived so quickly, actually. So you get a really nice looking patch, and I'm guessing this one, the patches are refreshed every year, aren't they?
Yeah,
change every year. So this is cool. This is like and it's a big patch as well. It's a big square patch, and you get your membership card, and there's a thank you note in it as well. So it's really nice. I was really pleasantly surprised to open that package.
I've spoke to a few of the friends of mine recently about the old Star Wars fan club back in the day, back in the 80s.
Yeah.
And even in the 90s they did it, but you know, you got a physical pack. Back in the day, it was like the welcome letter from George and, you know, the pencil and the poster and the patch and the, like you say, the membership card you've got to have. And whilst it's smaller and more
concise than that for the Rancho membership kit. No less impressive. It's a beautiful little thing. I love getting mine. But we mentioned Virtual Museum. We spoke to Steve and Anne on the show, and we did say that we would keep people updated with what's coming to Virtual Museum. So if you've signed up on any of the subscriber levels, which was Padawan, Knight, Master, Council, and Insider, they all had different levels of pricing as you went through it, you will get different things come on your feed, your Virtual Museum feed. So just to give you a brief idea, I mean, on June 6th, Steve and the team posted the ROW, Rancho Obi-Wan, the Rao Experience, Welcome to the Museum, where Steve explains a little bit about what Rancho's all about. But also you get things like, I mean, May 31st, so going back about a week or so, behind the scenes, Turkey Trouble. So if you're a council member, you can access a little bit of information about the livestock. This sounds a bit out there, but if you ever go to Rancho, the livestock is a big part of it. They've got turkeys and chickens and dogs and cats and all sorts of things living around and in the fields around them. I'll read it to you. Rancho Obi-Wan is just that, a rancho. It's not big enough to be considered a ranch, but it's a charming little space just outside of Petaluma, California. We do, however, back up to larger fields, and as such, we have all kinds of wild animal visitors like deer, skunks, foxes, coyotes, weasels, badgers, and turkeys. And this is a piece about the turkeys. So, yeah, the chickens are all fenced off. The cats, they've got a couple of cats. They've got a couple of wonderful dogs. I learned something when I was at Rancho. I saw what we would sort of call almost like a moderate size, like a 5p piece size brown spider. If you saw it over here, you'd be like, ugh, spider. Over there, I saw a spider when I was getting some books out of one of the warehouses the one time, and I saw this spider, and a friend of mine said, don't go anywhere near that thing. I went, why? That's called a brown recluse. It's one of the most deadly spiders around here. I don't know whether he was ribbing me or he was being serious, but every time I see a brown spider since then, I just think of this word, brown recluse. It was very close to me, but not in a kind-hearted way, in a kind of a physical way that I'm getting creeped out thinking about it right now. But anyway, loads of stuff on the Virtual Museum. So if you've not signed up, there's a link on the front page of Fantatrax. So if you click on that, it takes you straight to the Virtual Museum page. There you can look at all the levels of membership that there are available. Pick your poison, get in there and have a look around. It is fantastic. I'm really enjoying it.
This is Steve Bloom, voice of Zebralios, and you're listening to Fantatrax Caravast. May the force be with you.
Okay, so the last couple of episodes have been really, really busy. We've not had time for a listener's question. Not to say we haven't had listener's questions when we rummaged through the listener's bag and pulled out this one. This is from John Paul Nichols, and it's a question we've kind of broached before, but I think, you know, as time moves on, our perspectives change a little bit, so it's not a bad one to sort of revisit. And the question is, with the Skywalker saga now complete and Taika Waititi co-writing and directing a new movie, what direction do you think Star Wars will head in? Old Republic, post First Order, a Shadows of the Empire type story. Over to you. Thanks from Paul. So thanks for that, Paul. Mark, I've been talking a lot the last few minutes. What do you think? Where do you think Taika's going to take us on our next intergalactic journey on the big screen?
Whatever I say, I'm going to be wrong.
I joke.
But it's one of those things, isn't it? It's like sometimes, but at the moment, it's wide open. I suspect that he'll probably do something in and around the era that we are still fairly familiar with.
Yeah.
I just get that idea. I don't know if he would push off too far. I just get the feeling that there's kind of that nostalgia link with Taika to the OT. So
yeah,
it could be that. Obviously, we've just had the announcement that the High Republic has all been pushed back in publishing. I always felt like the High Republic, they could almost use the publishing release and launch as kind of a bit of a, you know, an acid test just to see where people's thoughts are and if they're engaging with those characters and with that era. So that, I think, would be a fairly good and fertile ground to develop something in. I tell you what, though, I would be well up for a Shadows of the Empire-esque kind of TV show or a live-action droid series.
Honestly, man, that would totally be the dream. When CG first kicked off and Clone Wars was really taking off sort of 2008 time, I remember sitting back then thinking, Anthony Daniels did all the audio back in 84, 85, whenever they recorded the audio for the show. I think the show was 85. It's all there. It's all done. How difficult, stroke simple, would it be to either revisit and revoice them and do it all fresh with new voice actors? But what a shame to not use the original audio.
and just sort of give it a spruce it up, because those droids and Ewoks, I mean, to me, especially droids, not Ewoks was definitely pitched as kids, you know, like Squishies would have been and all the stuff that got mentioned that never happened. Joe Johnson was doing sketches for it, and Ben Burtt directed an episode, and Mickey Herman worked on it, and all the people that were working on the films were working on droids and doing stuff there. And you think where Ben Burtt went on to move on to, you know, and Wally. You mentioned, yeah, exactly, you know, and you mentioned Shadow of the Empire. I'm saying this from memory. I can't remember if it was the right name. It was Inverma de Werda or something like that. The song that's used in Shadows, there's lyrics in Shadows that came from droids, and the Moons of Bogdan was mentioned in droids, and there's all these little, General Grievous's wheel bike was from droids. There's all these little links to droids that work their way in. Like now we go, oh, Jon Favreau's using the creatures from Battle for Endor in Mandalorian, you know, and there's different things that seep their way in from different peripheral on the edges. Obviously, Mando's gun is from the holiday special. The thought of R2 and 3PO going out wandering around, to me, very much fit what George used to say back in the day about, oh, well, R2 and 3PO are those two characters from Japanese mythology. They're the two wandering minstrel sort of characters. And R2 and 3PO being without masters for certain periods of time and changing ownership always felt like it fit. So it, I was always I was a little bit disappointed in Solo that you didn't see R2 and 3PO just sort of wandering around on their own adventures, because they, goodness knows, they kind of went off to find fruit and cakes and stuff in Clone Wars often enough. You know, there's little things that could happen that they could go off and just not be just working for the royal household of whatever.
And I guess also at the end of the day, Mungo Baobab is pretty much the original Dash Rendar.
That's a good call. Yeah.
One of my favourite characters in all of Star Wars, believe it or not, I think is cool. It's wide open. What do you think?
My head tells me if it's Taika doing it, I actually very much agree with you. I think he would, you know, if Solo would have come along at a slightly different time and it hadn't been offered to Lord and Miller, you know, and Ragnarok had come out a year or two before and Taika's star had ascended quicker than it did, you know, obviously Jojo Rabbit is the real big win for him. My head tells me that he might have got a stab at the Solo film. I know before we started recording, we were talking about the Han Solo books, and they had a lovely sort of random little quirkiness about them, which in my head is very sort of 1979, because Hitchhikers was really taking off then. And again, that was a piece that was on the site the other day, you know, that at one point it never came to anything more than just being sort of put out there in the ether. But apparently at Lucasfilm, that, you know, Douglas Adams was considered for writing the Battle for Endor script. And it was Paul Chadwick who created Concrete, the comic, had put it out there. Yeah. And he actually replied to the tweet I put out and said, well, you know, almost writing it is a little bit strong. He never almost wrote it, but his name was sort of put out there as one of the people they thought about. But Douglas Adams was notoriously slow at writing. He literally had to be locked in his hotel room. My point being is that Hitchhikers had that weird quirkiness. My Star Wars fanfic was every bit as much Hitchhikers as it was Star Wars. It just had that weird quirkiness about it, and the Solo books have that. And I watched a bit of what we do in the Shadows, the film, last night, and the series is back very soon, which Mark Hamill's in, and Ragnarok couldn't be quirkier if it tried. You know, it's just got that off-kilterness about it. And I think if he was involved in launching the High Republic, to me anyway, he would have to go very much against his directing style, his sensibilities, to seriously set up a new era. It would need to be up and running for a while. Maybe I'm doing him a disservice. That's just my read of it. But for him to have a standalone Star Wars story set in the classic Star Wars era that he grew up loving, it feels to me like that would work. And that's why my head tells me that he would have been great doing Solo. Lousy comparison, but I will say it anyway. When Spielberg's making Jurassic Park, who knew the next film we would make would be Schindler's List? You know, where did that come from? You know, we'd done The Color Purple. It was a great film, but Schindler's List is like next level. And you see it, the great popularist Spielberg pulls out one of the great cinema pieces in Schindler's List, and people were like, wow. So maybe Taika's got that, I hope he does, he's got that in him somewhere down the line. Now maybe Star Wars isn't the venue, or, you know, the place to do that, because quirky and off-kilter and humorous is so natural to him. He's just a bloody funny bloke, and you see it on Disney Gallery, you know, he's just funny bones, isn't he?
Yeah.
My head tells me that something in a familiar surrounding, but just got that bank heist kind of funny vibe about it, that feels like it would fit. But like I say, maybe I'm doing him a disservice by saying that.
Possibly. You know, obviously it's very difficult to comment exactly on some of these directors, because their work can be so varied. But also, you're not necessarily wrong. I think where Taika, at least from what we've seen, works pretty well is that he can comment on stuff in that world. And I guess if you're going to start a new era of Star Wars, you need somebody who is going to be able to really world build.
Yes.
So you're going to need somebody who can either just be able to kind of come up with these wide concepts. I mean, a bit like JJ, but also John Favreau and even Colin Trevorrow. There's something about the way that Colin Trevorrow actually discusses and talks about film that it's a little bit more kind of, I wouldn't say educated, but there's just kind of like a learnedness about it. He can have fun, but there's kind of an authenticity about it. Whereas I think Taika can be, I think from his background as an actor and more of a comedian as well, I think there's that jovialness about him. So whereas actually where it works with when he directed Ragnarok is that actually you're kind of being able to send up a little bit within the bounds of actually what is accepted within that you know, genre and that film series.
I suppose it's the difference between holding a mirror up to society and building the society. And I suppose, like you say, Trevorrow, okay, Trevorrow's building on what came in the original Jurassic trilogy, but gave you something new enough that it felt fresh. Jurassic World is second only to Jurassic Park for me as in that whole series of films. I'm really looking forward to the third one, Dominion, next year. Mentioning Trevorrow, I'd love to see him actually get his hands on a Star Wars project and really run with it. I know people will go back to the Episode 9 version that he was working on. You can't call it Rise of Skywalker because it wouldn't have been called that if he'd have made it. But it was really early doors. It was, you know, that had to go through iteration after iteration to get where it would have got to. You know, you wouldn't have seen the film that we saw those rough ideas for. That's not what we would have seen, because that's just not how film works, is it? You know, you don't just film the first pitch.
Correct.
I'd love to see his eye come to Star Wars. But Taika, just again, I don't want to sound like I'm disrespecting him in any way. I only know of Taika what I've seen him make so far. And what I've seen from him so far tells me that to world build and kick off a new era in, be it the Old Republic, because cinematically it would be, even though we're all familiar with elements of it from books and comics and computer games, cinematically we're not, other than those sort of animated video things we got for Old Republic sort of 10 years ago. A post-First Order would make sense, because if you could get them back, you've got a great cast there you could potentially do stuff with. And I agree with you. I mean, it's just a Shadows of the Empire type story. It may mean literally Shadows or something of that style, you know, and it is kind of the whole crux, it's quite a broad story really, you know. You've got the Boba Fett angle of getting Han Solo back to Jabba the Hutt and him having his travails and trials, battle over Tatooine and all that stuff, the pop-up book and all the different things that we got. And then there's obviously the Sheezor story and Leia and Luke and Chewie undercover and all that stuff from that side of it, and Dash Rendar coming into it, you know, because he needed a Han Solo type character. So you got Dash Rendar because Mungo Baobab was busy, you know. So you know, so there's all these different potential opportunities. I'd like to see him tell a standalone and, like Solo, I love that film. I've just reviewed Double or Nothing, the Lando comic, the first issue. And it was fine. I enjoyed it. It was good, you know, and I enjoyed it. But point being, it was more of that Solo era with those characters and the characters as they were in that film. And I really want to see more of that. So anything with that kind of vibe and that kind of feel would work for me. And I think Taika could do something that is actually witty rather than funny. Like the difference between Star Trek 4 and 5. Star Trek 5 is sort of slapstick and trying to be funny. Star Trek 4 is just funny without trying. You know, and I want to see a Star Wars film that's like that. We've had it in the past. You know, Empire has moments that are kind of just witty and funny, and it's in there. JJ's great at that, at humorous bits. You know, the Starkiller-based stuff near the end of the film. There's some really funny bits. That's not how the Force works and all that sort of stuff. There's some really just easily funny stuff in there. So Star Wars can do it, and I'd like to see Taika do that. So that's all from episode 41 of Making Tracks. Thanks for listening as always. If you want to be part of the action and stay updated on all the latest Star Wars news, visit fanthatracks.com or check out the Fanthatracks app through the App Store to follow us on your mobile device. You can reach out to us and send in your listeners' questions by emailing radio@fanthatracks.com. Please send them in. The more contemporary, the more up-to-date, the better, but we will literally talk about anything. You can comment, like and share on any of our social media feeds at Fanthatracks, and be sure to subscribe, leave a review, preferably a 5-star one, on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or your podcast or smart speaker of choice. Mark, thank you as always, and should we come back again in a week's time, talk nonsense again about Star Wars in about a week?
Let's do it. Let's definitely talk more Star Wars nonsense.
Brilliant. Have a good week.
You take care.
Coming up next on Fantha Tracks Radio, it's Cannon Fodder.